This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark. On my way here, I was trying to think of a song to kickstart the show. As you know, as regular listeners know, I always pick songs, and I get guests to pick songs from films or pieces of score. And I just couldn't think of anything. And then it started raining, and it hit me like that. I thought of a song, and it's from the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Weirdly, I'm trying to think why they wrote this song for that film, because I don't recall there being rain. But this was written by Bacharach and David, who wrote a million amazing songs. This is Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, sung by BJ Thomas, from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did need some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done, sleeping on the job. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one
lovely song. That's put me in a good mood. James Gill has joined me he's just got here. We've got a great show for you, by the way. Today we have the excellent writer creator Howard Overman in with us today. We'll be speaking to him in a minute, but first I'm going to be chatting to James Gill, as ever, about all things films and TV, if he can gather his thoughts, because his train was delayed and he literally walked in 10 seconds ago. We almost didn't know what we were going to do. I might have just chatted to myself.
I'm so sorry that I did that to you.
It's not your fault.
Sweating profusely.
It's the classic, it rains a little bit, the country goes into meltdown.
Yeah. What train network is it? Southeastern, I guess?
Yeah.
Grrr. Yeah.
Jeremy Corbyn's got a thing or two to say about that. how are you, James? You okay?
Yeah, other all than good. That? Everything is all good.
Yeah, all good. I don't believe you. There's a cloud over your head.
Do you think so?
Yeah, a little bit. And also, you were texting me on the way here talking about stuff you wanted to chat about, and yet again, 2 weeks in a row, it sounded like doom and gloom.
So this show, since I've been doing it with you, it's an honour to be your guest. It's always been very positive, and yeah, we did comment that the last two shows, including what we're going to talk about today, is pretty negative stuff. But it's not in our nature. We're both positive guys, but it's just a few announcements where you're like, oh, come on, Hollywood.
Yeah. So what's the latest thing that's bugged you?
Well, so Justin Lin, if me of 6 months ago listened to me right now, I wouldn't believe it, but yeah. Justin Lin, it's been announced that he's going to direct the movie version of the toy Hot Wheels. Now, Justin Lin is a director I've interviewed. He's a lovely man. He's incredibly bright. I mean, he's a great director. His track record speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And it just felt a bit, oh man, when it was announced. So this comes in the wake of obviously the Transformers movies have been going for a while, but then also there's talk of a Tetris movie. There was the Battleship movie a couple of years ago. Ridley Scott was once linked with a Monopoly movie that never materialised.
I mean, what is a Monopoly? What is a Monopoly movie?
I mean, how do you make a movie out of Battleship? Yeah. You know, I mean, they made it, and I'm still not sure that they quite managed it.
Mm. Lee's making Twister.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see that.
Yeah.
He would make that work, would Mike?
Yeah, that would
Jim
be
Jim Broadbent
good.
Would be in it. It would be quite dark.
It would be like an Abigail's party, basically.
That's exactly what I thought. Abigail's party with Twister. Mike, if you're listening, please.
I'm sure he needs ideas.
We'll put a nice happy spin on something.
What is Hot Wheels?
So Hot Wheels, I mean, I think they were slightly after my time, but I think they were like little dinky cars that kids used to race on the carpet. Classic case of, on the advert, Hot Wheels would look amazing, and then you get them home and on your thick lounge rug, you'd be like, oh, this is absolutely bobbins. So it's just, I think they're just toy cars, aren't they?
There is like one example where a good toy film or game film was made and it was actually good. I'm not talking about Super Mario Brothers. I'm talking, of course, about the Lego movie. Actually,
you might be right. So the Lego movie, I'm sure when that was announced, people like you and were like, oh, come on. But those two guys are just, I mean, they're borderline geniuses, aren't they? And what they did with that film, you know, to make a film about multinational corporations and selling out and the theme of happiness and then the twist at the end. I mean, the Lego movie, as it happens, is probably one of the most original movies.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about that. But so, then it's such a, you know, unicorn in this that there's no, I can't think of any other
unicorn
whereas,
in the forest, isn't
yeah,
it?
It really is.
I can't think of, moving on to video games, I can't think of a single video game movie adaptation that has been good, not one.
No, I'm not big on video games, but Assassin's Creed is a video game.
There's quite a bit of pressure out on that. Yeah. Pressure on that this Christmas. Fassbender is doing Assassin's Creed. Will it be good? We shall see. The trailer looks all right. I've defended the trailer on here before.
Yeah.
But that will be the first one so far.
Now, I noticed this morning I was on the Empire website and they said that there was a Alfred Hitchcock Presents remake in the works.
But even that, so
well, Hitchcock Presents.
So I got the impression that you were quite excited about that.
No, not excited. I was intrigued by it because I'm thinking there was a time where, like, from a point of view as a writer myself and pitching shows to networks or channels or whatever, you would always be told that anthology doesn't work.
Sure.
Standalone stories do not work. People won't return. Now I'm wondering what's the change there, because there have been some examples, like, is it American Horror Story?
That's right. That's
each,
an anthology.
I mean, I know that's a serialized and then each season is different.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of an anthology.
That's right.
Black Mirror is very popular. Very excited about the new Netflix versions, which is basically Black Mirror times 100 because they've got all the money they need in the world. Is someone going, oh, actually, maybe there is something in this? And being the, you know, the world that we live in, well, how can we do it but with a pre-existing brand?
It ties into what we said last week. They've had to take an existing brand. Just do an original idea. Ditch the Hitchcock thing. We all love Hitchcock. Yeah. Ditch the Hitchcock. Do something new.
But, you know, that's the world we live in, sadly.
Dan, I feel like after this we need a hug.
But I have to say, I did get a little bit excited, not by the prospect of the show itself, but I was like, I sort of remember that. I'm sure I'm
with you. I sort of remember it.
And then I played the little trailer and this piece of music. If you're my age, this should really bring a little joy to you.
I know what this is going to be. sing something else. Here we go.
Now, that to me beautiful. Is that I for
you're
some
like
reason
Richard
thought that
Clayman
was the
there.
Laurel and Hardy music. But I heard that this morning. I was like, oh yeah, I remember this.
Yeah,
this has brought back fond memories. But I think there's a potential there in the world where we are sort of running out of ideas. Maybe that is a good format to. When I say ideas, I don't mean for stories, but for like sort of brands and stuff. Who knows?
Well, someone who does anthologies, and they do them brilliantly, South Park. So I know you're a fan of that, but yeah. They've changed now. So instead of doing standalone episodes, the past couple of seasons have gone for the anthology thing where they tell a single overarching story over multiple episodes, and they are absolutely nailing it. Mm-hmm. I strongly recommend that.
Well, so here's a segue into the next section, which is talking about TV shows that are based on films. We've had, for years, we've had films based on TV shows. You know, like that. There was that era of things like Lost in Space and the Beverly Hillbillies.
Do you remember that? There was a real
Flintstones
purple patch of pretty average movies that were based on. I mean,
sort of tongue in cheek kind of remakes.
I mean, as I'm a child who grew up in the 80s, and so the A Team is one of my favourite shows of all time. It was so exciting, and they just didn't quite nail the movie, did they?
Yeah. Well, it's because do you do a sort of piss take, or do you take it seriously? You know, it's a hard thing to, like Miami Vice, that was a weird one. That
was
because
that went quite dark, didn't it? And that wasn't great.
You know,
it was
weird...
fine. I interviewed the director,
Michael Mann,
Rawson Marshall Thurber, the guy directed Dodgeball and Central Intelligence. Mm-hmm. And this didn't run in the mag, so I can tell you this as a kind
exclusive.
Of exclusive. So he has written, like me, he grew up in the 80s. He's a lot richer than me, but he grew up in the 80s, and as much as I loved the A-Team, he loved Magnum, right?
Right.
And so he has written a script for Magnum, and it's not a Mickey take. It's mm-hmm. it's a sincere, genuine movie, and it's very much as he described it. It's like Batman Begins, this is Magnum Begins. So this is how Magnum beats Higgins.
This is
absolutely
Begins.
For real. So it's not going to be called Magnum Begins,
but this is his
absolute passion project.
Okay.
So now, the only thing that's stopping this movie getting made, because this guy's hot stuff, because Central Intelligence did well, he's making a movie with The Rock in China called Skyscraper. Mm-hmm. It's a disaster movie. There are rights issues concerning who owns the rights to Magnum, and once they get cleared up, he will make that movie.
Okay, but tell me this. How do you pitch Magnum in a one-line sentence? Like, what is Magnum? Because that's what I'm struggling
to
go with.
Because ultimately, to you and me, what is Magnum? It's Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
It's Tom Selleck in a Hawaiian shirt. Yes! It's Tom Selleck, the best moustache we will ever see in our lives, in a Hawaiian shirt.
But what is it?
He's a private detective in Hawaii. No, I'm with you. I don't disagree with you. I agree with you. How do you pitch it? Into like Paramount or whatever.
Yeah.
He's a detective.
Why can't you not bother with all these rights issues and just write a PI movie?
I just call it, you know, Shagnum.
Yeah, or Cornetto.
Yes!
Or, you know.
Yours is better.
Yeah.
But I think because he loves the character so much that he would have as many of the original characters as possible, and it would be faithful to the TV mm-hmm. show as well.
Yeah.
I would love to see that. Because he talked about it with such passion, and he really meant it, and it wasn't a guy that was just hanging an idea on an existing brand. It's not like when someone, like a director, gets offered a job. There's one really big example, and I don't want to say it because I don't want to get sued, but there are times where a director will be approached by a studio, here, make this movie for a sackload of cash, it's an existing brand, they probably don't care about it that much, yeah sure I'll do it, and the movie turns out to be not that great. But because he cared so much about Magnum, mm-hmm. I actually would have high hopes for that. But that again is a unicorn, because it's not often where the person who's writing it and directing it cares so much. They'll often just chop it in for a load of cash.
Across the board, how do you feel about remakes? Because some people, I think, get a little bit too precious about remakes.
So I think certain movies are worthy of a remake. So, for example, when it was announced that Magnificent Seven was being remade, mm-hmm. McQueen is my all-time hero. So, however, the Magnificent Seven, if you watch the original, you could easily chop 30, 40 minutes out of that film. So I wasn't against that film being remade. Haven't yet seen the remake. Unfortunately, it appears it's not that brilliant. But certain films are ripe for a remake. Because a lot of movies back in the 50s and 60s, they often were way too
Yeah.
Slow. You know, slow. When you watch some of them now, you're like, oh, God, then this is a classic.
Well, you know, we've talked about this as well, where I've, you know, championed a comedy from the 80s and sort of like forced someone to watch it if they hadn't seen it. And then I'm sitting there watching it with them going, God, this is much slower than I remember.
Yeah.
And that's just obviously, you know, we've got used to a different pace.
But I think that's it. I think because we all have ADHD, we've just got used to a different pace.
Yeah.
If there's not a car chase, an explosion, or, you know, a zingy one-liner, it can be tricky. Rob Schneider was once being interviewed, and he had done something with John Cleese, and John Cleese gave him discs of Fawlty Towers, and Rob Schneider said, you know, these are masterpieces, they're incredible. But he said they're more like plays, in that what Cleese was doing, I mean, it's one of the greatest sitcoms of all time, but what Cleese was doing was spending 10, 50, maybe even 20 minutes to build up, to heighten the tension. Mm-hmm. So when the high farce kicks in at the end, it was like this joyous release, whereas now there's too much reliance on, say, Big Bang Theory is one example. Every other line is a gag, and it's just, it doesn't quite...
Yeah, but there's always been that, like things like Bilko and stuff that were always, like American shows were always more like about the joke and the one-liner and the...
Well, but the difference there is that in Phil Silvers, you talk about one of the greatest comedy actors who's ever drawn breath. Sorry, go on.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
I've never been hugely into Fawlty Towers.
Really?
Yeah, and one of the reasons why is I find it too stressful to watch. Like, whenever I watch something where I go, if you just went over there and said, no, this is what I really meant, the whole problem would be solved.
But I think because Cleese commits to it so much...
Don't get me wrong, I think he's amazing, and I can see why it's a great show, but it just puts me on edge in not an enjoyable way.
Really?
I know that's like sacrilege, but hey, you know, we've all got shows that everyone loves that you just maybe aren't and I'm not saying I think it's bad either. I just don't enjoy watching it. I find it a bit like, oh, you know, it's a misunderstanding, just, you know, or, you know, stop being so stupid. I don't know. It's like you shouldn't put logic into a farce because then the whole thing doesn't work. But you're looking at me like you cannot believe words coming out of my mouth.
I'm surprised you because we.
And I love Python. I love Fish Called Wanda. I love every, you know, Terry Gilliam. I love that whole world. But just that show, for some reason, stresses me out.
I think in all the time we've known each other, this is the first thing we've ever disagreed on.
Well, that's fine.
That's good.
I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm just saying I don't like the feeling it gives me. Is that okay?
Yeah,
You still don't quite. So going back to the anthology and the TV remakes and the film remakes, here's a show that I was a huge fan of when it came out. And again, it's a bit like, why are they doing this? But it was Fargo. And that's based on a film, and it's an anthology because they're doing a different each season. There's been a few things. So today I read it was announced that they're thinking of doing they're planning on doing an Italian Job remake.
Yes.
A TV show. And there's been a few. There's been like Minority Report. There's been...
A lot of these have ended up... Like Minority Report, which I think is a bona fide classic, and I think
a movie,
absolutely incredible. But I think it got cancelled, didn't it? Quite quickly as a TV
12
show.
Monkeys.
Yeah,
there's a lot. There's been Zombieland. They're trying it.
Zombieland didn't even make it to air, did it? I think they made a pilot, and then I believe it got axed after the pilot. I mean, these are brilliant movies as well, but they just haven't
really
quite
good.
Translated to.
And I remember hearing about Minority Report, and because I'm such a big fan of that film,
I think it's amazing.
I'm like, how do you? I mean, you're making life really difficult for yourself by trying to do a series off the back of an almost pitch-perfect movie.
It's almost pitch-perfect movie, and also the movie's so perfectly tied up in a nice little bow by the end that not any part of me watched that movie and thought, I'll tell you what, this is like a cracking TV show.
Yeah. I tell you what, I need another 24 episodes of this. Yeah.
Of course, the big example of a TV show that was probably better than the movie is MASH.
Yes, that's... Yeah,
but
so
again,
now we're going back the other
now
way.
Now we're back to the unicorn, because it might even be the only one.
Or the example where a film is better than the TV show is On the Buses.
Yeah, you win.
What about that in the 70s when there was just a huge wave of TV, like movies of sitcoms? And
so
they were big.
They were big.
Like
they
people actually paid money to sit in the cinema to see Reg Varney in the cinema.
They did really... Reg Varney on the big screen, finally. But they did really well as well, didn't they?
Apparently, yeah.
The modern sitcom that sparked this new wave of sitcom movies was The Inbetweeners, which made
But that again,
truckloads of cash.
That's the third unicorn.
Well, Mrs. Brown's boys, and I will defend Brendan O'Carroll.
People always say that. Look,
people will say what?
They go, look, you know, they'll go, I defend Mrs. Brown. Look, we all know that it's a show that does well. I've had so many people in here thinking it's big and clever to say, I actually don't think it's that bad or whatever.
No, what I would say is, I didn't realise that. What I would say about that guy is that he's...
Maybe they don't say it to each other, just only on radio.
On this show, that guy has worked incredibly hard, and is that sitcom for you and me? No, it's probably not, but there's no doubt that it's a huge mega smash, and I'm not sure the guy should get the stick that he gets.
No. I mean, look, I'm going to say this publicly just because I'm not saying this in a mean way. It's not for me. But you can't argue with 10 million people. You just simply try. Get 10 million people in a room and argue with them.
Good luck. They will kill you. But I mean, these days, most sitcoms are lucky if they get 1 or 2 million. Mm-hmm. And the fact that show is getting the numbers that it gets, you've got to applaud the guy.
I know, but does that mean you can... I haven't seen the film. I heard about the reviews and stuff, but then, you know, so what? It's people love the show, so they'll probably love the film.
I mean, last week we talked about a dearth of audiences. I mean, for that, people have been queuing around the block. I mean, it's took in loads of cash, didn't it?
Yeah. And it's weird with the in-betweeners one, because obviously it's a great show and people like it, but there are a lot of other shows that are as good that couldn't have done that with a film. I think there's so much about the timing of it.
I thought with the movie they nailed it. It wasn't just a case of a longer version of the sitcom. I thought as a film both of them totally worked, and both of them were super successful. I really enjoyed both in-betweeners movies. I thought they worked brilliantly.
So
I tell you, there's one other thing we were going to talk about, and it ties back into something Dan and I talked about a few months ago. Was we predicted that Disney would raid its back catalogue of cartoons and turn them into live action movies, and we sort of said, watch this space. And then after that, this is very I told you so, but it's why we do the show, isn't it, to be honest. And then after that, they would cue the Jungle Book, and then now Beauty and the Beast is coming out, and then now it's just been announced that Jon Favreau will direct a live action version of The Lion King.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you... So basically like The Jungle Book,
I guess so, yeah. Like The Jungle
But there
Book.
Aren't any humans in
No, them. It would just be, I mean...
So when they say live action, they mean
CGI.
Yeah, because unless he's going to direct actual lions...
Unless they're going
to
train...
That I would pay a lot of money to see.
I would queue in the rain to see that.
I'd love to see the making of...
Another Morley?
Yeah, and like Jon Favreau going up to a lion. Now listen, I didn't quite get that you're sad in that scene. If you could just look, remember, you've lost your child.
Jon Favreau.
I mean, can you not say some words, maybe?
Jon Favreau, first thing on set every morning. So another minute silence. We lost another crew member yesterday.
That's two a day. So in a way, a weird thing to call it a live action. Version of it, isn't it?
Because there's none. No. It was like, you know, Tarzan. Yeah. That entire movie was filmed in Watford.
Was it?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Watford's quite green. There is a lot of vine.
A green screen. And unfortunately, it shows. Well, tell you what, Dan. Yeah. How's about for next week? I will make it my mission to find as many positive and original stories as possible rather than remakes.
Well, you know what's... we will be entering very shortly the award season, which will last about 6 months. But
that's right.
You know, traditionally or historically, that has been when more films to my taste start appearing a bit. So hopefully in the coming months, there'll be some interesting films to watch, good performances and stuff. So, you know.
I wanted to ask you a question. Mm. Have you seen the new Ghostbusters yet? I say new.
No.
Have you watched it yet?
No.
Okay.
Do you remember I said to you, I've just got no interest.
You're definitely not going to watch it. Okay.
No, I'll watch it if it's on the TV or something, but I don't know. And nothing about when it came out and the reaction has made me go, actually, I should see it.
Check this out.
Not that it got slated or anything, but it just felt a bit lukewarm. That's not enough to get me...
That's not enough to justify your 11 quid at your local Odeon. Or any other cinema chain.
Yes, that you know. I tell you what I am going to see this week is The Girl with the Gifts. No, what's
Girl
it called?
With All the Gifts.
Girl with All the Gifts. Have you seen that yet?
It's supposed to be good, isn't it?
Yeah. Going to see, that's Paddy Considine. Who else is
Gemma
in that?
Arterton.
Gemma Arterton. Looks pretty cool. I'll tell you what I think about it.
Will you go see Deepwater Horizon?
I will. But obviously, that's a film that probably I'll have to see on my own because I'm not sure my girlfriend wants to see a movie about an oil rig exploding and men sweating to put the fire out.
Well, the
but it's got three of my favourite actors, John Malkovich, Kurt Russell, yes, who I adore, and Mark Wahlberg, who I never knew I was a big fan of until you kept going, you know, he's amazing. And I thought, actually, he's in a lot of films I love. So he must be doing something right. Anyway, listen, we've got to wrap it up.
Sorry.
We've got an amazing guest who's got a really huge body of work to talk about. James, come in next week. Let's be positive. Let's
be positive. That's my homework.
Let's push through into the autumn with positivity.
But I would say the last 2 weeks we can only, you know, play with the cards you dealt.
Exactly. Now, this is the first song from our next guest, first choice. And he picked a piece of score first, and this is from the film Miller's Crossing, the main theme. It's a beautiful piece of music. I think it's just called Main Theme, I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Strangely uplifting and romantic for a piece of score that essentially accompanies a dark noir gangster film, isn't it? Like, if I heard that, I'd think, oh, this is for like a film about a lonely Irishman wandering the fields or something.
Well, I think that's why it works, isn't it? That it sort of plays the juxtaposition about, you know, them walking through the forest just about to shoot the guy in the head, and there's actually sort of a really beautiful piece of music playing. And I just think it's that sort of juxtaposition, and the Coen brothers made the trees look good.
It's such a beauty. Is that Roger Deakins, that film? Do we know?
I don't know that much detail.
He's done loads of their films. I love it when... By the way, everyone, please welcome, if you're at home, give a round of applause, maybe, for our guest today, Howard Overman. Howard, I love it when films do that. I always... one of my favourite pieces of score is the Hans Zimmer piece from True Romance, which... I believe is a homage to Badlands, but that really beautiful, sweet music, and then there being ultra-violence going on.
Yeah, do you know what? I should have probably picked True Romance. That's one of my friends actually played that at their wedding, so that's got fond memories for me. Yeah.
And did they like kill loads of people shortly afterwards?
No, they are still together, so it worked for them.
Did you? Why did you pick Miller's Crossing? Is it just because you love the film, or was it the music specifically?
I really remember the music sticking with me. It just the sort of one of those sort of, you know, it's quite, I'm not sure that many people have seen the film, but it's just a really sort of evocative, emotional piece. And I just remember really loving it. It's just one of the things that stuck with me. So, you know, there's other pieces of score which are sort of favourites. But I saw that script sitting on my shelf when I was trying to answer your questions yesterday and went with it.
So, Howard, you are the creator stroke writer of a ridiculous amount of shows. Some of these you created, some of these you've written on. You might have to like help me out which ones you were your own brainchild and which you worked on, but these shows include everything from Hustle, New Tricks, Moving Wallpaper, Hotel Babylon, Spooks, Merlin, Dirk Gently, Vexed, Atlantic, Misfits, and of course your new show that you're here to talk about, Crazy Head. They're not shows that have gone unnoticed. They've all had pretty good viewing figures. You're in good company there.
Yeah, most of the ones at the start, I was just sort of a new writer and just, you know, I didn't create those. I just wrote episodes.
I know you created Misfits and Crazy Head. Yeah. Which of these other shows did you create?
Atlantis, Vexed.
Okay.
Although I'm not that proud of that one, to be honest. Some of the others on there, I can't remember.
Which was adapted from the
Douglas Adams novel.
Well, we had Mark Gatiss on last week, and he obviously co-created the new version of Sherlock, and it's that weird thing of when you do an adaptation that's sort of quite new or different or got a spin on it, it's like... Are you the creator of, or are you the adapter of? You know, because it becomes all about TV format. You know, that sort of speak.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I don't know how familiar people be with the Dirk Gently books, but you know, and actually, there's a new version coming out on BBC America.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
It was written by the guy. John Landis's son, I think his name is Max Landis.
Yeah, Max Landis.
John Landis being the American Werewolf in London guy. I don't know why I'm promoting his show.
but Max Landis is a brilliant screenwriter as well. He wrote is it called Chronicle?
Brilliant film.
Actually, I can imagine you liking that kind of, knowing some of your work here. But what do you prefer? Obviously, the rewards of creating a show are much greater. But are there benefits? I was going to say, what do you prefer, like being a writer on a show or creating your own show? Because I'm sure they do have pros and cons, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you sort of aim as a writer to sort of create your own shows and executive produce them, and you know that's seen as the sort of pinnacle. But obviously, with that comes a sort of lot of responsibility and pressure, and you put your head above the parapet, and it's you that gets slagged off if it goes wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, so part of me, you know, does remember the sort of fond days of just writing single episodes of other people's shows and just sort of enjoying just doing the simple process of writing rather than all the sort of baggage which comes with sort of executive producing, like the casting and worrying about budgets and all. all that sort of stuff. So this sort of swings around about. So obviously, you know, you
do you not like that stuff, the more production-y stuff, or do you feel, do you see yourself as very much a writer, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, that's my, you know, I suppose that that's what I sort of, you know, bring to the party, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I've got sort of business partners who do much more on the production side and are much sort of better producers than me. I just find budgets and sort of, you know, sets and who's building what, you know, it's just not my thing, yeah. You know. But I mean,
I don't know whose thing budgets are.
Oh,
I mean,
budgets are a big
people
thing.
Like, I know, but I mean, like, who, like, this is the thing, right? So I've written, I've directed and stuff. The one thing that I would never ever have any aspiration to is producing. Like phoning people up and giving them bad news all day, every day, and
is that what a producer does?
Right, that's what it seems like to me. Like dealing with problems all the time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think, you know, because for me, when I write, I see sort of a perfect version.
Yeah.
In my head, there's no budgetary constraints.
So you must be constantly disappointed.
Well, I think there's levels of disappointment. Yeah. You know, you know what you're trying to achieve, I think, as a writer, is get the finished product as close to that perfect version in your head.
Yeah.
I mean, it's never going to be spot on because in your head, everything is perfect. There's no budgetary constraints.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's just this sort of, you know, unattainable nirvana. But what you're aiming to do is get as close to that as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if you can get a sort of good chunk of the way there, then you're satisfied. Although, you know, you inevitably, as a writer, sort of what you see is the faults with it and things you should have done better or things someone else should have done better, or, you know, and you just can't help but be sort of ultra critical of your own stuff. Because
yeah.
I think if you sit there and go, oh my God, this is a work of genius, I just think you probably, you know, lost that sort of sense of sort of perspective and, you know, and just all got a bit egotistical.
Yeah. Do you have you had written stuff that where you've very clearly seen it shot a certain way or performed by certain actors, and then when you watch the final thing or you get presented with it, you're like, that is nothing like what I imagined.
Oh God, you have some stuff that you get in and they show it to you and they're all sitting there thinking, oh, everybody's going to like it. And you sit there and you think, they have balls this up.
Really?
Oh God, yeah.
And anything that you think they ballsed up and then it went on to be a hit and you're like, oh, well, maybe they knew better. Maybe they knew my script better than I did.
Well, maybe. Look, it's all subjective. You know,
yeah.
It's all a matter of opinion. And, you know, the truth is, no one knows. Until it goes out, no one, you know, everyone claims that they know. But no one knows what's going to work and what's going to strike a chord with the audience. And you know, you always sort of, you know, you just got to do your best and sort of hope people like it. And that's all you can do.
Are you good at detaching yourself from the success and failure of shows? Well, I suppose, why would you detach yourself from success? But
I actually think you've got to detach yourself from both.
Yeah.
Because I don't actually read any reviews or anything. I occasionally get things.
People
stuck.
Say that. I'm not sure I believe them.
I genuinely
really?
Don't. I avoid, anything. You know, I have done in the past.
Yeah.
But I actually learnt from that.
Yeah.
It's because, say if they slag you off, obviously it doesn't make you feel, you know, good about yourself or the show.
Yeah.
And if they praise you, to, then I'm not sure that actually helps you either, because you've just got to sort of stay sort of like, you know, what you think is best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I just think that, especially in the age of sort of social media, I'm not on Twitter or anything like that. I just try and avoid all that sort of side of things.
Were you ever on Twitter?
No, I've never.
Okay.
I've never.
Facebook?
No.
How do you do that? I'd love to do that.
We just don't have an account.
That's
how you do it.
You say that, but like,
you're in a different profession. You probably need one.
Well, I guess. I mean, I do less like comedy, less live stuff at the moment, and therefore I don't need to like sell tickets and stuff. And that's where I think those things are really useful, like when you're actually trying to promote a product.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I don't use them that much for personal, and I sometimes get not abused, that's a bit strong, but like people going, good, why don't you do more on social media, why aren't you funnier, or why? It's just that isn't how I don't walk around going, oh, I better write that onto it. It's just not how I think. But I am weirdly a sort of I like looking and seeing what other people are saying, and I get all my news feeds on Twitter. You know,
I've stopped carrying my phone.
Have you?
Yeah, at the weekend, I don't carry
it. You're like
it.
A Buddhist monk
or
something.
I know, but because I've got kids.
And I bet you're happy as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I would say so.
I knew it. Listen, this is proof that the world we're living in does not bring happiness.
Well, I think it's different. I've got kids, so, you know, at the weekends, that's all, you know, I don't want to be sort of stood there looking at my phone while they sort of, sort of beg for attention from me while, you know, I check the football scores or whatever. And, people get annoyed because they can't get hold of you, but
Well, you know what, I was going to ask you a little bit about your process as a writer, because, you know, this show is, you know, it's a little bit nerdy in the sense that we like to give aspiring actors, writers, directors, whatever, like a bit of an insight into the way people actually work. And I was going to ask you whether you're a 9-to-5 writer, whether you have good discipline, or whether you're a procrastinator, but by the sounds of it, you've probably not got that many distractions if you're not online that much.
I am, when it comes to writing, I am, you know, in my little cell from, you know, depending on what I'm doing, but maybe from 8 till 6, and I just, like, there's nothing in there but a desk and a chair and my computer. And
are you actually in prison? Is this what you're telling us?
I'll tell you what, if you see my
you're
office,
on day release,
it's the dullest.
That's
space.
Why you haven't got social media.
Yeah,
you're exactly. Actually an inmate. I see.
And no one's ever allowed.
That's
there.
Why you wrote Misfits.
Exactly. Yeah. No one's allowed in this room.
Yeah.
No one's ever been there other than
where
me.
Is this room?
It's in an office block, mm-hmm. and away from the house and away from everybody. And I just go there and I write. And that's all I do in that room.
And you start at 8?
Depending on, so, you know.
Do you start straight... Do you sit at the computer and you're just straight in?
Cup of tea, in.
That's amazing. Do you do any sort of form of meditation or exercise? Like,
oh, yeah, I do exercise afterwards, but not, like, during the day, just sort of... That's when, you know, that's not all day, every day.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
and
but it's not all day, every day, because you can't concentrate. It's just because you're doing other things, right?
Yeah,
but it sounds to me like you're pretty good at just... I really struggle with, when I write, sort of just cracking on straight away. But unless I'm so in the middle of a project that I'm excited about and it's going well.
But do you know what? I sort of, like, you know, talk with sort of, when, you know, especially when I was doing Misfits, sort of talk to sort of young writers thing, and they'd say, oh, yeah, but I got stuck on that or whatever. And I'm just like, well, go do something. You know, if I can't work out how to write a scene, then I'll go to the next scene.
Yeah.
Because you can always go back. Yeah. And get something down. Don't progress it. Just, you know, because you go back and you look at it the next day and you might go, God, that is shit.
Yeah.
But at least you've sort of got to the end of it, and then you can go and you realise it, and from that you get another direction. And I just sort of, it's that sort of like a shark, so mm-hmm. momentum is everything.
Definitely. And I think I learned one of the things I did learn very early on was just get it, like, a first draft doesn't have to be perfect.
No.
You know, because I started writing in a trio, because we were doing sketch comedy, and it was more fun because you were with people and it was, you know, less lonely. But we'd spend 4 hours arguing over a character's name. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then when I first started writing on my own, I was like, I've just written 7 pages in the same time.
And,
like,
no one even probably said that character's name.
Yeah.
It was just on a piece of paper, so, you know.
And you could change it later. So, you know, it's just getting that first draft down and then going back and then crying when you realise there's about 5% of it is usable. But
at least
so
you've
what?
Got 5%, you know. Yeah. Sort of, you know, get it down.
So you've written a bizarre... range of stuff. I know some of them you were a writer for hire, but Vexed, you say, was one of your... By the way, why did you say you're not quite so into that one? Is it just how it came out?
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Well,
I know the show. It was...
It was a
Lucy Punch,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, comedy police procedural.
Yeah.
Some things for, you know.
I like your honesty, by the way.
Well, there's no point in sitting here and go, it's all genius, because it's clearly not.
Yeah. You did two series, didn't you?
Well, I didn't write on the second series.
Oh, okay. But you created it.
Yeah.
So you've obviously done like a police procedural that was a kind of
comedy.
Thing, and Dirk Gently, you've done Atlantic, which is fantasy,
Atlantis,
and then there's so you've done, like, genre, you've done relationship stuff, you've done kind of, there's a whole different, do you think in terms of what the genre is going to be, or do you come up with, like, what do you want to write about first? Or
I just think you can't, there's sort of, like, you know, and that's that's sort of the body of work which was made. You know, I've got sort of other things I've got written which, you know, haven't been made. You know, which I'd,
well, we
you
can
know,
read which, them aloud now. If
yeah,
you like.
We've got a couple of hours. Are you ready with accents? We need to. Okay. We'll have to do a couple of characters.
Annoyingly, I'm not great at accents. You know, it's helped me back all these years.
And sorry, I've forgotten what the question was.
Well, you do so many different kind of genres and styles and tone. Is that a? Do you think of like, oh, I want to do something like this? What genre would be? What comes first, I guess, the genre or the story or the, you know?
I suppose it's usually sort of a central idea, just something that sort of, you know, inspires. I mean, most of the stuff I do has an element of comedy in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that's partly because maybe that's the stuff that gets commissioned. I've got sort of like slightly more sort of serious stuff which hasn't been commissioned, but maybe I haven't been commissioning, so I'm not so good at it. But
I think there's definitely something in people always want the same as the last thing you did.
I think there's,
which is frustrating if you want to.
Well, you can get you can get pigeon. You know, they think, oh, who can do a sort of funny genre mashup? Yeah. You know, and then they come to you because you've done
before. Funny genre mashup guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
They look through their filing cabinet and go for you. Do you know what? It totally varies. You know, I just sort of an idea I'm developing for ITV at the moment, just, you know, script development, just came from the idea of, I live in Brighton, and the trains between London and Brighton are terrible at the moment, mm-hmm. and people have been delayed for hours.
We've had
hours
a bit of train chat today, so we know all about that.
And there's been sort of like, you know, I saw someone crying on the train, a guy crying because he couldn't get home, and, you know, and he'd obviously just having a total meltdown. And it's just, you know, from that, I've sort of come up with an idea about a guy who basically has a midlife crisis because, you know, he's made to re-interview for his job, and he's stuck on a train. He knows if he doesn't get there, he's going to lose his job. And it's just like little things like that. Like seeing a guy, you know, obviously I didn't help him in any way. I just thought, here we go. I've got an idea here, you know.
Keep crying, mate. I'm coming up with ideas here.
I'm on something. Have a total breakdown. And that would be
if you
really
could push
happy.
It, if you could even maybe jump, that would be, that would really help my story.
That's the ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that sort of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that I've yet to sort of really tap into, which is really look into what's happening around me more. So you've written now for E4, BBC One, BBC Two, ITV. Now that's kind of a remarkable thing to be able to do, because whether this is true or not, I'm always told by producers, commissioners, that when you come up with an idea, you have to think about who you're pitching it to. Like each version, like, so Misfits, for example, feels like a very E4 show, right?
Yeah.
And that's fair enough to say, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but was it always like that? Or did you originally have a BBC One version of Misfits?
No, you couldn't. I mean, I'm not sure you should think of the channel when you're coming up with it. I think, you know, come up with an idea and then, you know, be brutally honest, see where you can sell it.
Yeah.
Is the brutal reality. But if you want to get it made.
But the audience is like, so the thing you've just told me about that you're developing for ITV, that's a really great, simple idea that actually you could do a young, and I say this in inverted commas, young person's show. Version of, you could do an adult, but you could do ITV.
Whoa. No, I'm not sure you could, because
really?
This guy, you could tell this guy was a sort of middle class guy who did a certain type of, you know, I'm assuming this from, you know, his appearance and what he said and all the rest of it. And he was obviously having a midlife crisis, which, you know, is a guy of a certain age, you know, probably with kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could deduce that he'd been doing his job a long time, like, you know, he was mid 40s or whatever. And you just think, you know, that naturally fits more into a sort of BBC One, ITV sort of age demographic. Yeah. And I think, you know, just that, you know, I suppose it's just sort of like, you know, I look at my friends, and some of my friends have just lost their jobs and things. And it's for the first time in life, you know, you sort of looking at things in a different sort of way. And I think that's sort of more, you know, ITV One, BBC. But I don't think of, you know, when I come out with the idea, I come, you know, stick with the idea first and then think about who I can sort of, you know, go and talk to.
There must be like finite differences between BBC One and ITV. Just finite must be, right?
What do you mean by finite differences?
Well, just like, you know, tonally, what, like the kind of, I think I can often tell the difference between a drama or comedy drama on ITV to BBC One.
If you look at their hit shows, I mean, their shows which are the sort of big shows, mm-hmm. Sherlock, ITV would do Sherlock and BBC
One. But I think it would be slightly different.
Oh, see, the Polly is from BBC One Drama, head of BBC One Drama, has just moved across to ITV.
Has she?
Yeah, so I'm not sure that the differences will be, you know, and Kevin Ligo, who's sort of the control of, I can't remember, director of ITV, you know, he's got sort of, you know, really good taste in drama. And I think
he commissioned my first ever thing I wrote for TV.
Oh, did he? What was that?
Many years ago. It was a show called The Estate Agents. And I was 22, 23 when I wrote that.
Oh, wow.
I co-wrote it with two friends, very talented guys. And sadly didn't quite land, you know, it was one of those ones. The very first thing I did, I learnt the hard way about the business.
But you know, the idea that, you know, everything you do is going to work and be a 5-series hit, and it just not going to happen.
Yes,
you know.
So. Well, although you say that, but you do have a number of stuff that you've. I mean, to have Misfits and now Crazy Head, like, which looks like it could be a hit. I mean, it's definitely got all the things that Misfits had in a way. It feels very much like a companion piece to that show.
Well, I think it's just what we were talking about, that sort of, like, you know, a channel, if you've had sort of, you know, a hit on a channel, mm-hmm. and they want, first of all, they'll always say to you, well, we want something totally different to Misfits.
Yeah.
And a year later, they'll say to you, have you got anything vaguely similar, you know, in a similar sort of ballpark?
Here's my favourite one. I had a show on the BBC called How Not to Live Your Life, and a new guy came in and cancelled the show.
Yeah.
And then I was pitching, I wrote a new thing that they commissioned me to write, a new show. And honestly, their note was, could you make it more like How Not to Live Your Life? I was like, what, the show you just cancelled?
Yeah.
I mean, I could do more of that if you'd rather.
Well, unfortunately, that is the world of TV commissioning. And I was listening to your, before I came in, I caught a bit of the thing about remakes.
Yeah.
And my favourite remake that I've just read about is they're remaking Magnum P.I., but with Magnum's daughter.
What?
Yeah, and it's going to be...
James was just saying, he was just talking about this.
I missed that bit.
Yeah, he was just saying that he knows a guy that's written, or not knows a guy, he interviewed for when he worked at Shortlist, he interviewed a writer who's working on a Magnum remake.
Yeah, but it's going to be Magnum's Daughter. Now
which
it's
is a good title, Magnum's Daughter. It's like a sort of airport novel, isn't it? I mean, there's some real questionable remakes out there. But then some, like I just mentioned, Fargo. That to me was a real surprise that was such a good show. Like, I was like, how do you turn that into a series? But I thought they did a fantastic job. Can you tell us a bit about Crazy Head? Like, and when does it come out? When does it start?
Oh, God, that's the sort of thing I should know.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm looking at a door then to think the answer might be
We'll find out. October. That's all you need to know right now. October. Keep it. So can you do it? Well, do the one-line pitch.
Oh, God. What's the one? I should be better prepared, shouldn't I?
No, this is... are you good at pitching?
I'm all right in, like, you know, going into sort of broadcasting.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like, I'm terrible, like, in interviews. Yeah, when coming
promotion.
Up with some sort of, like...
Promotion's awful. Snap.
Maybe if I was on Twitter, I'd be better at these snappy answers.
I don't think so. I think promoting yourself is quite difficult. I think it's better when other people promote you. But in a room with broadcasters, are you good? Because writers are obviously, by their nature, people that are quite introverted. They spend a lot of time on their own.
Yeah.
So to do something where you really have to put yourself on the line in a room with other people is quite...
Yeah. Do you know what? I find it all right if they're English.
Yeah.
They're American.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to go down some Brexit route here for a minute. Like, you know,
if
they're bloody foreign. the American pitching is a whole other song and dance, isn't it?
Yeah, because they are, you know, and sometimes they just, you make a joke, you think, oh, that's funny. Well, and it's just stony silence, you know. And
I pitched something in America once. In the style that I would in the UK, where I just kind of described it in
low key,
3-minute pitch.
You're
and
not
then
saying
there was
great.
Silence where they were clearly waiting for another 20 minutes of pitching, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to make this up.
There's a whole level of salesmanship over there. People are sort of, you know, animated and sort of, you know.
So Crazy Head, come on, you need to just tell us. Don't right. do the one-line
yeah,
pitch.
Yeah.
Just tell us what it's about.
It's a show about... some girls who have special gifts, abilities, and basically they can see people who are possessed by demonic spirits. So, you know, the idea is that these sort of girls are the few who can sort of tell who is and who isn't possessed. And it just mm-hmm. sort of came out that, you know, I'm sort of fascinated by things like possession, this idea that, you know, sort of good and evil, and you could be inhabited by something which changes you and makes you do things. And, you know, it's sort of steeped in our sort of mythology, this idea that people have been possessed over the ages. And it's a sort of dark genre comedy take on that whole thing and the experience these two girls go through as they sort of battle these sort of possessed souls.
And is that at the forefront, or is it also a way of telling story about like young girls?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you say stories about young girls, that
well, yeah,
okay.
You know, I'm talking about like the lives of
young women. Young women.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, it's important within all these sort of, you know, when I'm trying to sort of write a sort of, you know, a genre show like this, you know, just trying to have a rule that actually the emotional stories should work regardless. If you stripped mm-hmm. out all the genre stuff, you know, the stories about sort of love, friendship, family, whatever, should work even if none of the genre stuff was there, and it should operate on that level yeah. as well as the genre level. So, you know, you hope this sort of, you know, people sort of become attached to the characters and care about their friendship and their love lives
yeah.
in the same way as you might in, you know, a sort of, you know, straightforward relationship drama.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully you've got that layer of sort of genre that you sort of sprinkle on top of it, and it makes it all more complex and mm-hmm. funny and interesting.
Cool. Now, listen, we always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure. You picked a film. This is an interesting one for me, I think, in terms of that you've decided it was a guilty pleasure. You picked Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And the reason I say that's interesting is because I know people that would say that's an out-and-out, like, classic film or, like, a brilliant
okay.
film. But the weird thing is, those people that say that to me, I always say, I never liked it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never...
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I kind of do, actually. I just turned 40, actually, which, saying that out loud, it still shocks me. Not because of, you know, I don't mind getting old, but 40 just sounds... That's a whole other world, that is. But yeah. Anyway, we won't go down there, otherwise I'll start crying and thinking about mortality.
I mean, I was a bit... I actually phoned someone up at work with and said, God, I've got a name of guilty pleasure, and had to sort of think through a few guilty pleasures, because I never know...
What is guilty or not?
Yeah, what's a guilty pleasure? I suppose, you know, I suppose when you've got kids... and, you know, busy sort of life, the idea of spending 2 hours sitting down and watching Ferris Bueller's Day Off, that would be sort of guilty pleasure.
Mm.
But so maybe your sort of, you know, your parameters change, or is it guilty as in you shouldn't really like it? Or
I think, I tend to put it into two categories. It's either a film that you think, that you know is terrible, but you like anyway, or it's a film that you think people think is bad, but actually you think is underrated.
What's yours then?
Mine, I've said this before, I think mine's The Holiday, the rom-com with...
My wife loves that film.
Yeah. I know it's like cheesy and saccharine and awful, but okay. I weirdly enjoy it.
Well,
enjoy it.
There is then, I'll give you another guilty pleasure, which I've watched the other night, and it's the Richard Curtis film. Is it called Out of Time?
The time travel one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a guilty pleasure.
That is, but there's something about it, because it's about father. You know, I've got two sons, and it's about fathers and sons, which just makes you sort of like strikes an emotional chord.
Curtis films. That one I felt was a film in two halves. Like the first half was a different film to the second half. I liked the first half, and then it all went weird. Anyway, listen, Howard, it's been lovely talking to you. Annoyingly, we've run out of time. I could have chatted to you much, much more, but thanks so much, and good luck with Crazy Head. This is your second choice of... You just picked anything from Gross Point Blank as your second choice of song. We've already played Blister in the Sun, which is amazing song, but I thought I'd pick this one, because this sort of... Because I love... Gross Point Blank.
It's
one of my favourite films. And I was thinking of all the songs used in it, and I remembered this bit where they play Live and Let Die.
Is it in the fight in the food store? Is that Live and Let
Die? Yeah, it's he goes to his old childhood home, and it's been replaced with a Walmart.
And they're playing
the Guns N' Roses version of Live and Let Die, and then he runs in and it turns into the like music version. And it's a really clever use of the music. So to play out, this is Guns N' Roses with Live and Let Die. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks so much.
You were young and your heart was an open book. You used to say
Say live and laugh.